Okay, so in the last time we did this, we were discussing a little bit some of the issues and trying to construct a philosophy of halacha or philosophy of Yahadus from and where that comes from. We were talking about a little bit some of the issues. Again, these are all massive topics that we could speak a lot more about. Darshin and Tamei Dekra and Tamei Mitzvos. And in particular, I was trying to... Each one is, again, something to speak of more specifically. Tamei Mitzvos, you know, particularly the challenge being, you know, whether or not you are really depicting the system organically from within as an insider, you know, based on the values, and especially the values themselves rooted in the texts of Torah, or whether or not, you know, you always run the risk when you try to present some cohesive, larger structure, and you want to connect the dots, if you will, if you have a certain orientation, or if you have this perspective that there's a certain orientation that is will help you facilitate formulating like a broader philosophy of something. So you want to make sure that that structure or that... you know, that framework or those categories don't, you know, are useful and that they don't have too much undue substantive influence. And that you have to distinguish between, you know, terminology and helpful parallels or helpful simply ideas and descriptions and losing kind of the organic quality, you know, of what emerges from this. And this is implicitly, you know, some of the critiques of you know, previous systems of Tamei Mitzvos already by the Rishonim. Implicitly, this is the issue, and I was mentioning that more specifically, you know, in the more modern era, both the Rav Shamshon-Fall Hirsch and the Rav, who, you know, overlap in a lot of things, and who are very sensitive, you know, to these issues. They both had the background for it and the inclination, orientation, you know, to try to, you know, promulgate like a system of Yahadus, you know, that both of them really were very critical of previous attempts, even of previous attempts by, you know, revered authority figures, including some of the Rishonim, especially in the systems of Tamei Mitzvos, but of course even much more critical, you know, in more modern, non-traditional efforts to impose like secular philosophies, not just again in terms of a framework or language or parallels or articulation, but where the substance really creeped in and kind of transformed the whole thing. So it's fascinating to see those different critiques. And then, you know, it's it becomes, you know, once these considerations are well known, you know, to apply the same kind of standards that, you know, that's only fair, you know, to the systems that are, you know, promulgated by these critics or by the people who were critical of other efforts, whether it be Rav Hirsch or the Rav, or other, you know, parallel efforts. I just wanted to quote just for a couple of seconds, a couple of lines, just so you see that I'm not, you know, making it all up. But again, in the introduction, I'm just reading a little bit from the introduction of Dayan Grunfeld, who was the, I guess, the translator originally of Korev. You know, first wrote most of his stuff in German, very bombastic German, right? And, you know, required translation. It's undergone, some of these things have undergone a second translation already, certainly the Perush Al HaTorah and the... you know, the collected works were translated and so on. But Dayan Grunfeld was a big Talmud Chacham, and he was a critical part of making Rav Hirsch, Rav Hirsch's works accessible to English-speaking audiences. Most of this introduction pulls together skillfully, you know, certainly the ideas of Rav Hirsch in these issues, but also the language. So a lot of what I'm quoting, some of it is Dayan Grunfeld's, I'm just going to quote a few paragraphs, own formulation, but a lot of it, most of it really is based on the language, the translated language of Rav Hirsch. You know, we could throw a couple of, you know, German phrases in, you know, if we just want to satisfy your curiosity. So again, and you'll see that the considerations here are parallel to the ones that the Rav raises, each according to their own style, namely this question of being, you know, authentic, being organic, being, you know, what I call an insider, as opposed to, you know, with all sincerity, falling short of that by virtue of letting the framework or the categories, you know, end up being like kind of a foreign or a, you know, compromising influence on what should be, you know, something that is Al Taharas HaKodesh. So he says here, the mitzvahs are not only the Jew's guide in life, and this is a davar pashut to us, because we grew up on the Rav and these things, but they're not simple to most people, but also the source of his Weltanschauung, the mitzvahs, that is. Every detail of the mitzvah must be related to the great themes of man's life. Hirsch therefore insisted on the exposition of all details in the minutiae of Jewish law, not only in order to promote scrupulous observance, dikduke mitzvos, Hirsch always spoke about dikduke mitzvos, but also because he saw in every such detail a mine of information for Jewish philosophy and the Jewish outlook on life. This is on page, 45, 46 in the Hagdama. Hirsch takes great pains to show how a wrong terminology taken from the outside of Judaism, wrongly applied to Judaism itself, wrought havoc with the understanding of what authentic Judaism really is. There's the first term, religion. He didn't like the term religion, which in the ordinary meaning of the term cannot, so Hirsch points out, be applied to Judaism without distorting its real meaning. In his Perush on Shemos, right, Perek Vav, Pasuk Zayin, he has a whole excursus about this. I'm skipping that. This thought is further developed by Hirsch in his essay on the Festival of Revelation and the Uniqueness of the Torah, which he develops this as well. Here's a quote. It is simply not true that our inward frame of mind and our sentiments are the essence of the institutions of the Torah, while everything else is merely external framework or mantle. You'll see this, the Rav's going to say practically the same thing, just in his own terminology, meaning the view that what we think religion is, or spirituality is, our inward frame of mind, just to make it clear, our sentiments are the essence of the institutions of the Torah, and everything else is just, meaning the way that they are formulated as norms, as mitzvos, as chiyuvim, you know, that's just kind of extraneous, just a way of conveying, you know, what we subjectively, you know, respond to or relate to as spirituality. What the Torah desires to regulate is not just the thoughts and sentiments of man, but the whole of human existence, man's sensual impulses, his needs and desires, his individual life, as well as that of his family, society, and state. The Torah is the unique message of God addressed to man in his totality. The doctrinal part exclusively would cover only one small page, meaning, you know, Ikare Amuna. And really, you know, the primary contribution, of course, the Ikari Muna are critical and they're indispensable, is, you know, the mitzvos, because the mitzvos themselves embody a perspective on all aspects of life. But what he's trying to say is, it's not that we have a sense of, you know, what it is that moves us spiritually, you know, and then that, you know, we perceive that as being, you know, objectified, let's say, to use the Rav's terminology, in the mitzvos, or in Limud HaTorah, you know, and therefore it's mostly extraneous. He's saying that is what it is. It's the opposite. That's what he calls ceremony as opposed to real spirituality. Only those who have never looked attentively into the Torah can fail to realize how strictly it demands the observance of its laws relating to outward actions and especially to physical, sensual spheres of life. You have to understand the Rav Hirsch is combating the Reform, which is presenting itself, you know, in this period as, you know, the modern update, you know, of what otherwise is a crude and primitive, you know, Yahadus, which, you know, doesn't realize that its, you know, mitzvos are merely a shell, you know, but that, you know, the subjective responses that it evokes, you know, which anyways are rooted in what, you know, man you know, responds to in terms of spirituality, that's important as well. You know, that's really what's important. And these other things are, you know, the mechanism. And of course, mechanisms are extraneous. And what he's trying to say is that is absolutely not true. These are divine mechanisms. They dictate what constitutes proper religious impulses and sensibilities, not the opposite. You'll see the Rav says the same thing in his own way, which are quite outside the realm of what we usually call religion. Among the many laws belonging to this category, we should mention only the dietary law, because that was a big issue in the Reform, and the laws regulating sexual relations. Then he goes on, religion in general relates to the thoughts of men which find their expression in symbolic acts. He's describing now other views of religion, not our view of religion. And it doesn't sound so bad unless you, again, understand that this is subtly different, but in a very critical way. Religion in general relates to the thoughts of man which find their expression in symbolic actions. In any system of religion, therefore, the thought is the original important essential element, while the external symbolical expression of it is a secondary importance. But unlike religion, the Torah is not the thought of man, that's the emphasis, but the thought of God, expressed in divine laws, which are to be carried out by man as symbolic actions. It is by these symbolic actions ordained in the Torah that the divine thought is first implanted in man, instead of there being, you know, this kind of, universal, sense of what constitutes spirituality and religiosity, you know, and then man, you know, concretizing that into deeds. Most religions don't have divine laws. They have ceremonies that are generated by man, right, to express his feelings. And that is the opposite of what the Torah is. It's by these symbolic actions ordained in the Torah, the divine thought is first implanted in man. Right, this symbolic action is therefore of primary importance. The Torah is therefore a divine document, the authentic form of which must be kept and preserved with scrupulous accuracy, so man should be able to study and assimilate divine thoughts contained in it. As for the term ceremony, Hirsch considered these expressions first applied to Jewish laws during the German Jewish Reform era, have done more than anything else to spread a wrong conception of the essence of Judaism and to undermine the Jewish way of life. In an essay entitled The Jewish Ceremonial Laws, he writes, and so on, I once spoke at a Pigeon of Ben of a Talmud of mine, and I was trying to explain, you know, what the significance of the Pigeon of Ben ceremony was all about. And then when I finished, a Talmud Chacham who, you know, was former, I would say teacher, but who I knew for many, many years before, he came over to me and he said to me, you know, he really liked, I guess, the content of what he said, but he said he did a terrible thing by calling the Pigeon of Ben a ceremony. And I never understood where that came from until years later when I encountered Rav Hirsch's essay. He came from that background, and to him, just the phrase ceremony had such a corrupted meaning that, like, he couldn't even get past the fact that, Hakolafi Hamadaber Viv Hashomea. Obviously, the word ceremony isn't per se intrinsically a problematic term, but for Rav Hirsch, ceremony means something which distills the subjective feeling of spirituality, right, and then encapsulates it in some sort of, you know, concrete form, you know, so that it can be reinforced. And that's what a ceremony is. And that, of course, works in the opposite direction of a mitzvah, you know, with its divine origin and with its effort not to reflect what people are already drawn to or what they associate as religiosity, but to implant in them, right, batel ritzon chaler tzono sense, you know, what the Rabbonu Shel Olam wants them to respond to in terms of religiosity. And then later on, here on page 79 of this thing, how did all this come about? Because the reformers did not base their religious system on the Torah, because they did not develop it organically within Judaism, but brought with them a moral system from the outside, put a priori demands on Judaism, which ought to be this and that, instead of objectively investigating the sources of Judaism. Okay. Their preconceived notions, the object of modernizing it instead of examining the sources of Judaism as given phenomena, It is characteristic of modern science that it prefers not to construe a priori that which can be brought within the scope of observation. Consequently, any theory concerning Judaism as a religious philosophy or relating to the underlying ideas of any individual law of the Torah must be checked by and out of the classic sources of Judaism, the written text of the Torah and the Talmud, which contains its authentic interpretation. I'm skipping around. It was Hirsch's great merit to have applied to Judaism these methods of reasoning, and that is investigation of Judaism from within. Now here we get to say some German, aus sich selbst heraus, okay? Samson Raphael Hirsch applied the methodology of natural science, a good ha'ara, with the only difference that legal facts took the place of natural facts. Thus Hirsch, the representative of strict orthodoxy, was much more up-to-date in his method of research into and presentation of the Torah than the reformers who prided themselves on being modern and enlightened. Quote, it was indeed the cardinal mistake of post-emancipation Jewry that its leading non-orthodox thinkers, instead of basing their thoughts on the thought categories of Jewish tradition, used unscientific methods of approaching Jewish thought with the preconceived notions based on a priori systems from the outside. For anyone who knows the system of Kant, it's obvious that Geiger and his followers adopted Kant's conception of the so-called religious ceremonies, that's where it comes from, which in turn was influenced by Christian thought. For Kant, religion was merely a system of morality. He did not know Jewish law. This is actually an interesting piece. What he knew of so-called ceremonies was influenced by the teachings of Paul and Luther. Indeed, the latter's phrase, it is not the good deeds which make a good man, right, but the good man who does good deeds, could be taken as a paraphrase of Geiger's view of the halacha. Kant has been called the philosopher of Protestantism. Kant was consistent when he stated that whatever man invents by way of serving God other than a moral life is a mistaken, superfluous ceremonial. For he clearly referred to man-made ceremonies, which are only the outward expression of man's religious thoughts. Jewish law, however, the essence of which Kant could not be expected to know, are, as of Hirsch never tired of pointing out, not man-made ceremonies, but divinely prescribed symbolic acts by which godly thoughts enter the human mind. Or, quoting the Maharal Prague, the mitzvos are the ladder on which the Jew ascends to the higher life of the soul. Sulam mutzav arza, maybe. Right? Kant was not expected to know the essence of... He wants to make it clear here, because he's a fan of Kant, and so is of Hirsch, that he's not blaming Kant, you know, misuse of Kant. Kant was not expected to know the essence of Jewish law, and yet with the insight of a genius, he sensed that Judaism is fundamentally different from other religions, and expresses astonishment at the fact that Judaism is really not merely a religion, but a religious Staatsverschangung, right? Constitutional law in the sense of revealed legislation. The early reformers, most of whom had studied at Yeshivot, which is absolutely true, the earliest ones, right, should have known better than to take over Kant's moral philosophy and make it the basis of a Judaism, which in reality was anything but Judaism. Perhaps Isaac Breuer, who was the grandson of Rav Hirsch, the one who went to Eretz Yisrael, in other words, the brother of Rav Yosef Breuer, who was the founder of Kol Hadassah Shurim right here in Washington Heights, our neighbor. So Isaac Breuer was not far from the truth when he stated that had Kant been a Jew and known the essence of Jewish law, he might have spared us the Reform movement. Okay, that's a terrific line. I could not say that. Anyways, we find the parallel analysis, but again, just in different terminology. In the end of the halachic mind, we talked about it a little bit last time, the Rav just uses, slightly different philosophic terminology. He talks about objectification and reconstruction as opposed to construction and subjectivism. In other words, what Rav Hirsch was talking about as the difference between, let's say, ceremonial laws, and mitzvah satorah, is what the Rav is calling construction subjectivism as opposed to reconstruction and objectification, more or less. I'm not saying that they're 100% identical, but they're pretty close. So I'll just read again a couple of quick passages here on page 85, the beginning of the Jewish part. Objectification reaches its highest expression in the halacha. Halacha is in the act of seizing the subjective flow and converting it into enduring tangible magnitudes. But again, not the subjective flow that initiates in man or in his instinct about what constitutes spirituality, but the other way. In other words, that's why it's the objectification reconstruction. It's the subjective flow of what the Ribbono Shel Olam, in other words, what the divine norm wants man to feel in the context of spirituality. It's the crystallization of the fleeting individual experience into fixed principles and universal norms. In short, halacha is the objectifying instrument of our religious consciousness, the form principle of the transcendental act, the matrix in which the amorphous religious halo is cast. Rabbinic legalism, so derided by theologians, is nothing but an exact method of objectification, the modes of our response to what supremely impresses us. It's interesting to note that halacha frequently operates with quantitative standards. It attempts not only to objectify religiosity, but even to quantify it. The act of measurement is a cardinal principle in halacha, shiurim, and religious experience is often quantified and mathematically determined. Reminiscent of Galileo's dictum, the book of halacha is replete with triangles, circles, and squares. Hence, the reconstruction of subjective aspects within the objective halakhic order is far more complicated than that of the ordinary religious act. There's enormous distance between halakhic objectivity and its subjective counterpart. So this is a very important principle. And here's where he, here on page 86, he goes further. The reconstruction method is recommended, but it cannot generate a causal explanation of religion. Here's where he's suggesting that even if you start with the halacha and you move backwards, you know, and therefore you're starting from, you know, the authentic and the organic, right, you have to know what it is that you're trying to extract from it. And here the distinction between what he calls how or why questions as opposed to descriptive, reconstructive what questions is what he's referring to, and this is a critical part of the Rav's formulation. You know, what is it, you know, as opposed to, you know, why is it? And his argument is that whenever you speak of why, you're essentially holding the material, whatever it is, hostage to some extraneous other principle or idea. Whereas when you focus on what, you're kind of acknowledging the intrinsic, you know, value, or in this case, divinity, right, of the value itself. Yeah.
Rav, I can just ask two questions. One, is this like a similar, what you just said, is that a similar argument to what he makes in Accordity to Fact, that it can't, like you can't ask why?
Absolutely. Because this is, again, the Rav is very consistent in his thinking and in his categories. It's an excellent example. In Kol Dodo Dvik, when he speaks about the problem of theodicy, Yitzhak Verada, and he discusses how, you know, you shouldn't ask why, you know, because that's a futile question. He also there discusses how, you know, the history of asking why when it comes to theodicy, which is particularly, I mean, that's something, another thing to talk about, but, you know, again, you know, Medrash understands that that's part of the conversation of Moshe Rabbeinu and the Ribbono Shel Olam, Hareini Nas Kvodecha, you know, and, you know, what he did show him or what he didn't show him, and of course it's a critical part of the whole Sefer of Eov. So, but 100%, the Rav says, you know, that again, that has additional elements of, you know, being an inappropriate question if you're asking why, but also a futile question. And even if it wasn't inappropriate and futile, it would just be the wrong question to ask, because that's, according to the Rav, always the wrong question to ask. But the what question, meaning what is the normative response, how are we supposed to react when we encounter, you know, the dilemma, you know, of Tzadik Viralo, the theodicy, you know, is encountered, that's the right question. So that's a great example. Yeah.
And just the second question I'll ask, when you, before you turned the page, I was talking about the gap between objective religion and subjective religion.
Yeah.
Being very, is that in the sense of Kavana, in the, like what subjective aspect of religion?
No, he means a very, that's why I read the Rav Hirsch piece before. Because I think that in essence and in substance they're totally the same, meaning people have this, and this is something that the Rav speaks about also in a very famous footnote in Ish Halacha, right? Footnote 4. where he talks about, you know, how people associate religiosity, you know, with facile, easy answers, but also with, you know, basically subjectivism, you know, with what they think they need in their lives, and, you know, what gets them, you know, what gives them peace of mind or a sense of, you know, they associate with panacea, you know, with harmony, you know, with joy, you know, with easing, you know, their torment, you know, or providing, you know, either an entertaining, you know, or a satisfying, you know, pathway, you know, for them to live their lives. But in fact, you know, the system of halacha and Torah comes from the Ribbono Shel'olam, and it's intended to elevate us, and therefore it's not always, you know, we hope that it brings, well, it certainly is supposed to bring meaning, that's for sure. But whether meaning is always equivalent to peace, you know, or certainly not, you know, the struggle in trying to evolve, you know, and to grow spiritually. And therefore often paradox or difficulty, you know, that's what we talk. Yisurim shel whatever, you know, even Yisurim shel Ava. All of this is part and parcel of what religion really should be about. As opposed to, you know, the more behavioristic, you know, and more subjective, you know, what makes you feel good about yourself, about your life. Again, we live now, I mean, when the Rav's writing this, he lived then. And when Rav Hirsch was writing it, he lived then. I mean, this pull to, you know, satisfying man's, you know, sense of what constitutes meaning, you know, it's always an overwhelming, powerful impulse in society. You know, if you can give people what they want or what speaks to them more obviously, you know, that's always, you know, going to be much more compelling and attractive to them. So anybody who's, you know, kind of projecting, you know, a meaningful life, a religious life, a spiritual life, which comes from without, you know, and which requires, you know, that man not only, you know, extricate himself from his comfort zone, but that he, you know, kind of accept, batel ritzon chal ritzono, that he surrender, that he give up, you know, whatever it is always fighting an uphill battle. You know, that's just the way it is. So that's what the Rav is fighting here as well. Again, I was going to say, we live in a time where this is even more, because this is the postmodern era, and, you know, nothing, you know, is objective. You know, I'm not endorsing this, I'm being critical of it. And, you know, now it's expressing itself in, you know, even in the dropping of, you know, norms that were considered to be axiomatic and you know, universally accepted, you know, just 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And the impulse of everything, again, there are some good things that come out of it, agav, although they too are corrupted kind of by the, kind of the impulse, and, you know, and that is, you know, on the one hand, people are more empathetic, you know, they're more sensitive. I mean, this idea that you should defend people is mostly a good thing, but, you know, it's done in a very offensive way that offends other people or that isn't consistent, because at the end of the day, it isn't about the value of that. It's about subjectively appeasing or appealing, you know, and it's all just assessed in a purely subjective way, even at the expense of objective facts and objective categories, and that's very problematic. But you can see that in every era, you know, this is an issue, and why wouldn't it be? It's endemic to human beings that, you know, that they you know, are drawn, you know, to, you know, to what makes them feel good, you know, and to giving in to their appetites and, you know, to a path of, you know, least resistance. So that's what he means by it. He means that the halacha dictates what religiosity is, not man. Just like what Rav Kook was calling ceremonial as opposed to divine, you know, ritual, that's what the Rav is calling mostly, you know, reconstruction and objectification, being the Torah part, as opposed to construction and subjectivism. And this, again, in all of his writings and his talkings, like this idea of religious subjectivism was, I mean, you gave an example of it before, but it was that was the Rav's understanding of the Korach rebellion. He called the common sense rebellion is about religious subjectivism. It was like a very major leitmotif in all of his thinking and his writing, and understandably. Okay. The reconstruction method is recommended, but it cannot generate causal. This is a very important point, because you can, you know, go about the right methodology, but what he's suggesting is if you're looking for, you know, the wrong questions, and this is a tricky question because the blurred lines between why, what, and how questions is something that we're all, you know, cognizant of, and for sure the Rav was as well. Maybe I'll get back to this the next time. At this point, when we talk about how to actually do these things, at this point many philosophers have blundered. The curse of the why question followed them relentlessly. As soon as they had begun to interpret religious phenomena causally, they negated their very object. That's written, you know. The chief error of genetics can be clarified by reference to Hume's psychological genetics, and so on. I'm going to get to the Hume part. We'll skip that. In contrast with genetic methodology, a philosophy of religion following a retrospective procedure from the objective to the subjective realm does not eliminate its own object. The method of reconstruction yields more than relational explanatory exposition. It offers a multidimensional religious outlook to the homo religiosus, a term that he uses very much in Ish Halacha. The basic error of religious liberalism, which is what, you know, Hirsch was talking about in terms of the reform, but 100 years later, the religious liberalism in the Rav's time, is to be discerned less in its ideology than in its methodological approach. Liberalism has traveled in the wrong direction, from subjectivity to objectivity. Again, I'm always just very impressed how great minds and great souls, you know, really, in each of their own terminology, but basically, in a very sophisticated way, see things in a very similar way. And in so doing, is misconstrued both. Religious liberalism is based upon a very simple methodological principle. Subjective religiosity, the moderns say, is subordinated to the omnipotent authority of time and change. It's impossible, therefore, to consider any set of religious norms and dogmas as immutable, for the objective order, moving parallel to the subjective, undergoes the same metamorphosis. In other words, if it's the subjective impulses that are then, you know, that are important only, and they come, again, from man, because they're subjective, and then they are, like, codified or objectified into norms in order to make them, you know, in order to, you know, for them to, I guess, you know, be absorbed, you know, to be omnipresent and so on and so forth, you know, acharei ha-pu'ulot nimshachot, you know, and so on, then, you know, basically, you know, if the subjective impulses change in every generation, you know, then the forms can change. And even if the subjective impulses don't, the forms can change because they're just a instrument and they are, you know, not intrinsic, they're peripheral. And if you have new or better forms, you know, like now there's electricity, so we can, you know, rest on the Sabbath, you know, without any heavy lifting by doing all sorts of things, if you look at it in that kind of superficial way. Let us admit that modern religious subjectivism is indeed, this is a very important line, incommensurable with the objective order sanctioned by tradition. Sometimes it's important to know when you can't harmonize between, you know, cultural differences that are unbridgeable. One is still tempted to ask how the fathers of contemporary liberalism intend to mold a modern religious act out of the new chaotic mass of subjectivity. The method of objectification is, of course, at their disposal. They may project subjective flux upon externality and create a new artificial objective order. But this very method is fallacious. Then he goes on to explain, etc. Liberalism has approached its subject on page 90, matter with bias. It has boldly declared traditional dogmas to be incongruous with modern subjectivism. Now this, again, this paragraph is almost identical to the paragraph that I read, you know, in reverse, which is that when he was saying, you know, that the reformers, you know, projecting themselves and perceiving themselves as being, you know, more modern and scientific, you know, did the most unscientific thing, you know, that can be done, and that is, you know, they didn't really examine organically, you know, the authentic sources of the system they're trying to describe, right? Instead, they subjectively, you know, imposed external frameworks upon it because they had an a priori preconceived notion which wasn't rooted on study and immersion. That's what Rav's writing here. Liberalism has approached its subject matter with bias. It has boldly declared traditional dogmas to be incongruous with modern subjectivism. Actually, they have neither examined that ancient order of subjectivity out of which these quote-unquote old-fashioned concepts of God have evolved, nor have they investigated the religiosity of modern man. This being the case, the abandonment of certain traditional concepts in favor of more modern ones is nothing but sheer whimsicality, if not foolhardy, iconoclasm. If the commensurability of traditional beliefs with modern religious experience to be investigated, the method of retrospective exploration, the regressive movement from objective religious symbols to subjective flux must be applied. For were we to analyze the mystery of the God-man relationship as reflected in Jewish religious consciousness from both traditional and modern aspects, it would be necessary that we first gather all objectified data at our disposal. Here the Rav's telling you how to go about constructing a philosophy of halacha on a particular topic. First, what you do is you gather all objectified data at our disposal. Very reasonable, right? Passages in the Holy Writ, otherwise known as Torah Shebiksav, pertaining to divinity, divine attributes, the norms regulating God-man contact, such as the norm of love and fear of God, avanira, moments of tension between God and man, as in the case of Eov, many halachic problems or certain attitudes of man towards divinity have found their expression, all forms of cult, meaning, you know, the avodah, liturgy, prayer, Jewish mysticism, rational philosophy, religious movement, we'll talk about all this more concretely. Out of this enormous mass of objectified constructs, the underlying subjective aspects could gradually be reconstructed. Let's analyze them, see what's singular about them, as I'm speaking now, and try to see what patterns emerge, you know, both from, and here it's very important, I'll talk about that more, you know, from the primary normative material first, and then, you know, from there, also, you know, the narratives, myself, Osim and Labanim, the Agarata, you know, mysticism, when it's relevant, the underlying subjective aspects could gradually be reconstructed. The latter, in turn, should be compared to central structural facts of modern psychology, typology, and the philosophy of religion, meaning, you know, comparing and contrasting. It's not too far-fetched to anticipate the result of such an inquiry and predict that the traditional intimate God-man communion would not be as simple and naive as moderns would have us imagine. It's very doubtful whether this highly developed modern mind would reject such a concept of a personal God in intercourse with man as one that would, quote-unquote, mislead the simple and alienate the sophisticated. The scope of this essay does not permit a detailed analysis of the concept of God in religious religion. However, the methodological error at the root of the Reform ideology is clear. Although the method of reconstruction can be adopted and utilized by any theistic religion, it is, of course, immense importance in the field of Jewish philosophy. One of the most perplexing problems that has confused the finest of minds is the rationalization of the commandments, Tamei Mitzvos. The difficulties encountered by the Rambam in attempting to eliminate Sadia and Bachya's dualism of rational and traditionalist commandments, Shimios and Sichlios, and to develop an all-embracing interpretation of religious norms are well known. I mean, the Rambam didn't divide by Shimios and Sichlios, but he certainly also does agree that that those are categories, especially in Shemona Prakha, but that's not for now. Either way, here's where he is critical of Rambam's efforts and attributes his failure in Mor Nevuchim to this causal focus, meaning to the why and the how question that I mentioned last time we met. However, Maimonides' attempted rationalization, more so than any other of his theoretical undertakings, brought forth a historical controversy. Maimonides and anti-Maimonides, fine. And then he says, judging Maimonides' undertaking retrospectively, one must admit that the master whose thought shaped Jewish ideology for centuries to come did not succeed in making his interpretation of the commandments prevalent in our world perspective. While we recognize his opinions on more complicated problems as prophecy, teleology, creation, we completely ignore most of his rational notions regarding the commandments. The reluctance on the part of the Jewish homo religiosus to accept Maimonidean rationalistic ideas is not ascribable to any agnostic tendencies, but to the incontrovertible fact that such explanations, meaning the Rambam's more nevuchim tamei mitzvos, neither edify nor inspire the religious consciousness. They are essentially, if not entirely, valueless, very harsh, but very true, for the religious interests we have most at heart. Maimonides' failure to impress his rationalistic method upon the vivid religious consciousness to be attributed mainly to the fact that the central theme of Maimonidean exposition is the causalistic problem, the how question, the explanatory quest, and the genetic attitude determined by Maimonides' doctrine of the commandments. Instead of describing, Maimonides explained. Instead of reconstructing, he constructed. Then he goes on to say that whenever you do that, when you take the causal approach, the philosopher must transcend the boundary line of religion in order to find his answer, which lies beyond the religious domain. That's the tochen is being rationalized by something that comes from a different domain, and so on. For example, should he post the question, why did God forbid perjury? The intellectualistic philosopher would promptly reply, because it is contrary to the norm of truth. Thus he would explain a religious norm by an ethical precept, making religion the handmaid of ethics, and so on. And then he says, it is worthy of note that Maimonides, the halachic scholar, this is on bottom of 93, came nearer to the core of philosophical truth than Maimonides, the speculative philosopher, meaning that Tamei Mitzvos and Yad HaChazaka are far more appealing and relevant. In contradistinction to the causal method of the philosophical guide that leads to religious, techni, the halachic code apprehends the religious act in an entirely different light. The code does not pursue objective causation of the commandments, but attempts to reconstruct its subjective correlative. It would seem that Maimonides of the halacha was not intrigued by the how question. He freed himself of the genetic purview and employed a descriptive method of expounding the content and symbolic meaning of the religious norm. The what question was his guide in the code. A play in words. To illustrate the method of love, then he talks about three examples. He talks about shofar, etc. The details are not important. Then finally, finally, in the end of the essay, he concludes by being critical of, again, even modern Jewish philosophers who have created systems of hashkafa based on medieval Jewish philosophy. He's very unhappy with that. The living historical religious consciousness, meaning the halacha, shmiras hamitzvos, the experience of being involved in that way, Limud HaTorah, which embraces both antiquity and modern times, is ignored. Such a method cannot cope with problems of Jewish philosophy for three reasons. First, medieval Jewish thought, despite its accomplishments and merit, has not taken deep root in Jewish historical religious realism and has not shaped Jewish religious world perspective. When we speak of philosophy of religion, we must have in mind foremost the philosophy of religious realities experienced by an entire community, not some abstract metaphysics cultivated by an esoteric group of philosophers. Second, meaning the medieval Jewish philosophy didn't accurately capture, he's saying, the spirit or the content of mitzvos and of Talmud Torah. Second, they're overlapping ideas. We know that most central concepts of medieval Jewish philosophy are rooted in ancient Greek and medieval Arabic thought and are not of Jewish origin at all. Of course, that's somewhat controversial. Some Jewish sources claim, they got it from us. It's impossible to reconstruct a unique Jewish world perspective out of alien material. It echoes again the Rav Hirsch comment. Third, the Hegelian thesis that philosophy is synonymous with continuous process and activity was born out by contemporary scientific facts and has become a truism in modern philosophy. If Jewish philosophy is reduced to obsolete concepts and medieval categories, the time is rendered sterile. Where is the living philosophical continuity? To this end, now I'm on page 101, there is only one single source from which a Jewish philosophical Weltanschauung could emerge, the objective order, the halakha. In passing onward from the halakha and other objective constructs to a limitless subjective flux, we might possibly penetrate the basic structure of our religious consciousness. We might also evolve cognitive tendencies and aspects of our world interpretation, gradually grasp the mysteries of the religious halakhic act. Problems of freedom, causality, God, man, relationship, creation, nihility, would be illuminated by halachic principles. A new light could be shed on our apprehension of reality. The halachic compass would also guide us through the lanes of medieval philosophy. He's a little bit, not regretful, but, you know, this is the, I guess, the moderation of what was a seemingly dismissive, harsh, you know, rejection of medieval Jewish philosophy, which, of course, was written by great men and certainly has also much organic Jewish thinking in it. So he's saying, oh, if the halacha would be the guide, then that would also illuminate, you know, medieval Jewish philosophy and reveal the structural standards by which to judge and evaluate philosophical thought of the Golden Age. It would help us discriminate between the living and dead in Jewish philosophy. What, for instance, is of halachic nature in the guide and the Kuzari? What, merely an echo of Platonic Aristotelian philosophy? The purpose of such an analysis is not to eliminate non-Jewish elements. Far from it. For the blend of Greek and Jewish thought has oftentimes been truly magnificent. However, by tracing the Jewish trends and comparing them to the non-Jewish, we shall enrich our outlook and knowledge. Modern Jewish philosophy must be nurtured on the historical religious consciousness that has been projected onto a fixed objective screen. And then the famous ending, out of the sources of halacha, a new worldview awaits formulation. Very beautifully described. And again, this is, now the Rav didn't do this that often. It's not like he took numerous topics and applied, you know, this methodology. Although, of course, piecemeal, he did it a lot. Every time, you know, he certainly spoke, you know, about Hashkafa. In the books that have come out, you know, posthumously, because Rav wrote very, very, very little in his lifetime, but, you know, they put out a lot of his lectures and talks, particularly the Torah Sarav Foundation. And what they did was they took, you know, disparate talks, you know, that, and they organized them according to larger time, book on family life, you know, book on, you know, responding to suffering, you know, a book on, you know, community and, you know, the relationship between, you know, individual and community. But if you put it all together, again, he didn't do a lot of this. He didn't have time to do it. And you look at the patterns and the way of thinking, you do get, you know, certainly a lot of, you know, a benefit from it. And there is a an emerging, you know, hashkafa of halacha, you know, in many of these individual essays, and especially when you put them together, you know, in the same book and you juxtapose them, then, you know, it's really a very impressive thing. But of course, the goal is, you know, to try to integrate this into our daily lives and our daily learning. And when you take a step back and you think about it, that is really what we do, and the reason why the Havayas Davaya V'Rava occupy the central, you know, place in our lives, you know, that they do. Because this is exactly what he's described. We'll stop now, but we'll pick up with this a little bit, just some, you know, to try to make it relevant to things that we do on a regular basis. You know, this idea of, you know, learning the sugya and trying to identify, you know, not to, you know, dilute or homogenize, you know, the ideas based on others, you know, but on the contrary, to see what is singular about it and to juxtapose or contrast it, you know, whether it's with, you know, mitzvos b'nei noach where they exist, even with the overlap, or in some cases it's helpful, you know, comparative law or comparative cultural analysis. But to do that only from a position of having first immersed oneself, like both Rav Hirsch and the Rav said, in the minutiae of halacha, but not, you know, not to kill yourself with the minutiae, but to understand what patterns, you know, are established in terms of a particular approach to, you know, what's our approach to asceticism, and what is our approach to philanthropy, and what is our approach to community, you know, based on analysis of areas of halacha and the details and the patterns. And that's why I often speak about this so much, but, you know, the world of Brisk and what it promotes in terms of conceptual thinking and that framework is particularly conducive, right, to this kind of methodology. Now, it wasn't always, again, pursued in that way. So I want to speak a little bit about Rav Velvel's, you know, perspective on Parshanut and Agada and contrast it a little with the Rav next time, and then, but even more specifically, just to give some more concrete discussion of how this is connected to what we do on a regular basis.
That's a different thing.
What's going on? Yeah.